Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In a world full of flashpoints and conflicts, perhaps the least talked about and potentially most dangerous to U.S. security is the escalating rhetoric between China and Japan. Just last week at the Davos Economic Summit, Japanese Prime Minister Abe unleashed a verbal bombshell when he compared the two countries to England and Germany prior to World War I. Of course, we knew where that led to. Well, that statement resulted in equally inflammatory rhetoric from Beijing. Difficulty for the United States is we are treaty-bound to defend Japan. Seemingly, the conflict is over three barren rocks in the China Sea, but my guest today says the roots are far more complex. David Shambaugh is the director of the China Policy Program and a professor of political science at George Washington University, considered one of the top specialists on contemporary China. Prior to joining George Washington, he served at the University of London School of Oriental and African Studies and was the editor of the China Quarterly. He's also served as an analyst on the staff of the National Security Council East Asia Bureau and the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research. He's been a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution since 1998, previously directed the Asia Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He's the author of 11 books, and his most recent is titled China Goes Global, The Partial Power. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations late last week, and we spoke with him while he was here. David Shambaugh, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, great to be back.
Well, first of all, we need to talk about the tensions between China and Japan. As you know, in Davos, Japanese Prime Minister Abe made these, what to many people who are not really following the issues, pretty strange comments about likening the relationship between Japan and China to England and Germany before the First World War. Of course, the follow-up questions, well, that led to war, and he didn't rule out the fact that there could be war at some point. What's going on in these tensions?
Well, the Prime Minister's remarks are rather candid, but they're not inaccurate, actually. I myself share the view that the situation is analogous. Nothing's ever identical, and history doesn't ever repeat itself precisely, but the situation is analogous to Europe prior to the First World War. One also has to remember that time of the relationship between China and Japan at the turn of the century. They had a war in 1894-95, the first Sino-Japanese War, in which Japan defeated China summarily, sunk the entire Chinese ship in, I think, 36, the entire fleet, I should say, in 36 hours. And that, in fact, started the problems that continue to this very day. So right now they have disputes over rocks. Three big rocks, islands in the East China Sea. But that dispute dates, in fact, to the War of 1894-95 when Japan defeated China and seized control of those islands, which the Japanese call Senkaku, and the Chinese have a different term for it, Diaoyu. Japan also seized, as a result of that war, Okinawa, Taiwan, and Korea, colonized Korea, and then began Japan's move into northeast China, otherwise known as Manchuria. So, in fact, that war prior to the First World War is also analogous. And certainly in the Chinese mind, that is very fresh. So this dispute at the moment over these three rocks in the East China Sea is not about three rocks. It's about a century of aggression by Japan against China. At least that's the way the Chinese see it. And it's aggression that the Chinese believe the Japanese have never come to terms with themselves, much less sufficiently apologized to other countries, you know, that were the victims of Japanese aggression, particularly in the Second World War. Anyway, that analogy, I think, is important to bear in mind, because those of us who look at this issue today in the 21st century tend not to remember the aggression and the history of very bad blood that has existed ever since 1895, not just the Japanese invasion of China from 1937 to 45, which was horrific, with all kinds of atrocities committed. That, too, is an open wound, very open wound in China. It's an open wound in Korea, both North and South Korea. So Japan's problems, by the way, are not just with the Chinese. They're also with the Koreans. And in Southeast Asia, which Japan also conquered during the Second World War. So there's all of that. History is not unimportant. But Abe's comments in Switzerland at the Davos World Economic Forum The analogy there is to the European powers, and particularly, I guess, Britain and Germany, on the eve of the First World War, in which they were involved in an arms race, a naval arms race, so-called dreadnought arms race, and rising mutual suspicions that led to the First World War. There are a variety of other reasons that led to the First World War, which has been, this continues to be debated in the literature, a great new book out by Margaret Macmillan on that subject. But the point is that, and Abe's point, I assume, was that these two countries today, Japan and China, both heavily armed, both increasingly developed, both deeply suspicious of the other, and having a dispute over seemingly innocuous issues such as these rocks in the East China Sea, where in fact there are bigger, deeper issues that are pushing the two countries into conflict with each other. So, you know, I agree with him. I think and commend him, in fact, for making the analogy. And I think we need to be aware. I think there is, in fact, a danger of war between these two countries.
Well, we look at the economic side of it. You know, Japan for a generation was the leading economic power of the Far East. They've pretty much been eclipsed now by China, or are in the process of being eclipsed.
Well, you know, we should remember Japan's continuing economic strength. It's still the third leading economic power in the world, and it's the second leading power in Asia, and is only slightly behind China, if you will, in that regard. So Japan is not exactly a weak state, nor is it a weak military state. Qualitatively, the Japanese military is superior to China. Certainly its navy is. But the Chinese have caught up and surpassed Japan economically and in other areas. So these are two. This is a war waiting to happen. Some might say, you know, there's bad blood, extreme nationalism, revanchism, a trigger, which is the dispute over the islands, which in and of itself is not a reason.
Do they have any strategic or economic value?
Not particularly. There's no economic value. Nobody lives on these islands except some sheep. There are sheep there, but there are no human beings. They sit, you know, rather strategically in the sea lanes of Northeast Asia, you know, through which passes a lot of merchandise, cargo, and oil.
But they're not fortified.
They're not strategically.
They're not fortified. Yeah.
And Japan has controlled, administered, I should say, and controlled these islands since 1895, since they defeated China in that war. They took control of those islands. The Chinese, of course, never accepted that. Interestingly enough, at the end of the Second World War, at both the Yalta and the Potsdam conferences, all Japanese seized territories were returned to Chinese sovereignty by the parties concerned, including the United States. Roosevelt and Truman both acquiesced to that. However, then the United States, of course, occupied Japan at the end of the war, and in 1954, I think it was, transferred control over these islands to Japan. So the United States is a party here, not just at present, but historically. We contributed to the dispute by not returning the islands to Chinese sovereignty. We're also a party because of our alliance with Japan. Our government has said very clearly, the Obama administration, that the U.S.-Japan alliance applies to these islands. And if there is a conflict over these islands, the United States stands by and will defend Japan very clearly.
Now,
so
I've heard there are back channel discussions with Japan saying, look, don't make this a huge issue. I mean, we don't want to get involved with a conflict over these islands.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the United States doesn't want a conflict with China, doesn't want a war with China. That could be, it's unpredictable. It could be catastrophic. Both are nuclear powers. We don't have kind of rules of the road. And so the U.S. could be dragged into a conflict with China over these islands. So the U.S. has, you're quite right, Rich, there have been several back-channel visits made to Japan and to China, for that matter, telling officials in both countries to just cool it. The Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia, Danny Russell, I think is out there right now. He's in Beijing today, and he was in Japan earlier in the week. So we're trying to counsel restraint and caution and dialogue directly between the two parties. But neither party, well, I should say the Chinese don't want dialogue with the Japanese. The Japanese, Abe, for his part, says we're happy to talk to the Chinese about it, but the Chinese say we're not happy to talk to the Japanese about it, certainly in the wake of Abe's visit to the Asakuni Shrine just before Christmas, which surprised everyone, including Washington. I think the U.S. government got a six-hour notice.
And what's the Yasukuni Shrine?
The Yasukuni Shrine is a memorial in central Tokyo to commemorate Japan's war dead from various wars. It's the Arlington Cemetery of Japan. Problem is, there are 14 Class A war criminals' remains interred also at the Yasukuni Shrine, not just, you know.
And so this gets into the whole idea of Japan being a pacifist power in the wake of World War II.
Right, exactly. So Abe says, I was just going to the shrine to commemorate our war dead, you know, from history, and didn't mean any offense to any other East Asian neighbors. By the way, South Korea reacted as strongly to the visit as the Chinese did. And this has been a lightning rod for several years, this shrine. The former Japanese Prime Minister Koizumi visited several times, and that really escalated tensions during that period. Abe, when he came into office, said he wasn't going to, but now he has. So that's just poking a finger in the eye of both China and South Korea. Mm-hmm. And it was very unnecessary and, frankly, not very wise. So that's a problem. They're not talking to each other. So my point is that the American government's counseling of dialogue and restraint, is not going very far.
Before we move on to China, and I know you're a specialist on China, but the other thing that I'm reading about this conflict is that Japan, in this new government, they're looking to change their constitution,
right,
sort of get rid of some of the pacifist elements that became a part of the post-war constitution, mm-hmm, and to rebuild their military to an extent. I don't know if that's in response to China or if that's, just a reassertion of their power, military power. What's up with that in your mind?
Well, this is a longstanding issue in Japan, and for Abe himself, he has called for many years for the revision of Article 9 of the post-war constitution, which says that Japan shall never possess offensive weapons and never threaten any other country and shall not bear arms in an offensive manner, only for self-defense. And so this has been an ongoing debate for a long time, whether Japan should continue to live under the so-called pacifist constitution or should become, quote, a normal power. And by normal power, that means to possess normal military capability. So Abe has embarked, first of all, on constitutional revision, hasn't passed the Diet, the Japanese parliament, yet, but he's moving down that path. And he's certainly trying to modernize the Japanese militaries, increase the Japanese military budget, called for greater capabilities, meaning code word for offensive capabilities. So this is also in the mix. So this whole situation, I don't think Americans are frankly aware of, and we are not, sort of alert to the dangers of this. This could drag the United States into a war. And Abe's comments in Davos, I think, are quite apt, frankly. This is analogous to the eve of the First World War.
Mm. My guest today is David Chambaugh, the director of the China Policy Program at George Washington University, where he's a professor of political science. His most recent book of many he's written is titled China Goes Global, The Partial Power. He was the guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations. Well, let's talk about where China is in regards to the Chinese-U.S. relations. We have good relations at times, but there's an awful lot of tensions. There's an awful lot of problems. I mean, it goes to everything from whether markets are open or not, to hacking issues, to intellectual property. I mean, there's a whole range and to legitimate security fears. China's blue water navy is growing. We certainly still have a big presence in the Western Pacific, and I don't think there's any plans not to. What are the big tension points between U.S. and China today?
Well, Rich, I think you've noted a number of them just now, and there are many. There are many more tension points than there are areas of agreement and cooperation between the two countries. And the relationship between the two countries is a mixture, frankly, of cooperation and competition. That's always been the case. That's not new news. That goes back to President Nixon's opening to China in the early 1970s. We've always cooperated with and competed with the Chinese. The difference today is the balance between those two elements is now tipped towards the competitive side of the spectrum, and we have difficulties and competition, if you will, and differences in virtually every sphere, trade sphere, certainly the security sphere, human rights sphere, In fact, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to identify a single sphere in which the U.S. and China are working together and are in agreement. In the U.N. Security Council, there's kind of partial cooperation over issues such as Iran's nuclear program. Over North Korea, there's partial cooperation over North Korea's nuclear program. But, you know, one really has to stretch to say that these two countries are working together and on the same page strategically.
Let me ask you about North Korea, because everything I'm hearing is that the Chinese are really fed up with the North Koreans. I mean, just that relationship is deteriorating as much as anything.
Absolutely. They've been fed up with the North Koreans for a very long time. It's just reached a yet new and higher threshold under the current leader of North Korea, who has thumbed his nose at China as well as the rest of the world and made various provocative warlike actions towards South Korea. So that relationship for the Chinese is very tense. But at the end of the day, North Korea sits on China's doorstep and on its border, and they don't want instability in North Korea. They certainly don't want the regime to collapse. And they really don't want American forces, military forces, that is, in a unified Korea on their doorstep, as was the case back in the early 1950s that launched the Korean War. So the Chinese have really bitten their tongue and have aided and abetted, I think. Actually, I'm not very sympathetic with the Chinese on the North Korea issue. I think that they have contributed significantly to the deterioration over time of the issue, as well as North Korea's nuclear weapons capability. So it's not like they're just a passive party. They're a concerned party. They don't like what's going on. But they haven't, on the other hand, used any of their own leverage. And they're the only country that, frankly, does have any leverage over North Korea. They don't want to use it. So this whole problem with North Korea is somewhat of their own making, I think. But it's a very dangerous situation.
Where does China have leverage and where they are using leverage? Is there a place?
Oh, with North Korea?
Well, just in the world. I know they're doing an awful lot of aid to Africa. I've heard the naysayers would say propaganda to the world about China. But they're, you know, it's public relations around the world. But are they really using their leverage as an economic power?
Well, this gets into the whole subject of this new book of mine, China Goes Global, the subtitle of which is called The Partial Power. And what I mean by the partial power is that China's not a comprehensive power, and it's, more importantly, not an influential power. It is not influencing world events and setting standards in the world as a superpower should. They're very risk-averse. They're very passive. They don't, in fact, use their assets that they could, economic assets as well, and leverage that they could in various situations. They could be squeezing North Korea extremely hard. They could be squeezing Iran very hard. They could be squeezing Syria very hard. They could be doing a lot of things in the world using their economic leverage, but also their diplomatic influence, but they're not. So this is a country, it's kind of peculiar. This is why I call it a partial power. It's not behaving like a major global great power, at least in the way that history has seen to date. Now, they say that we're not going to be that kind of power. History has seen coercive powers for a long time. The Chinese say that's not the way we intend to be a power. But they're not using their leverage in any of these situations that they could be to advance agendas and to address world problems. I find them very kind of peculiarly passive in their international posture.
Is it mainly a concern with domestic affairs?
That's part of it. Well, there's several reasons for it. First is they've never been a world power in modern history before. They certainly were in pre-modern history. So this is all very new, and they don't really know how to use the instruments of power and what's in the toolbox and when to use what instruments in what situations. So there's a little bit of that.
And of course, through history, though, when rising powers have flexed their muscles, a lot of times that ends up in conflict with the other existing powers, which
absolutely,
that's something we would want to avoid as well.
That's right. And they are flexing their muscles a little bit on their periphery. They have these maritime disputes we were just speaking of with Japan. They have them with several Southeast Asian countries. They still have a land border dispute with India.
And Russia.
No, they've demarcated. The China-Russia border has now been demarcated, and they have a pretty good relationship with the Russians, in fact. But they have managed to alienate virtually every one of their other neighbors in recent years. So their own neighborhood views China very suspiciously. So the Chinese are not giving the reassurances that they could be. This is also the use of power. Power is not just coercive, it's reassurance. And the Chinese don't really do that very well either. That's why in the book I call them a lonely power. They have no allies, not a single one. And they have no real close friends in the world. Russia, perhaps, is the closest. Pakistan and Cambodia. Those are the only three countries that would, you can say, have a close relationship to the Chinese. But everybody else has a mixed to poor relationship with China. That includes the United States.
Well, let's talk about their domestic situation, because one of the things we've seen is this tremendous boom in their economy over the last decade and a half, and really maybe going back two decades. And it's had an enormous transformation. You know, you have extreme wealth in China, and I would say that from what I can see, the average Chinese wages are going up significantly as well. They have a long way to go, but they're going up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you look at their growth rates, I mean, you know, 7% is considered down. That's a down quarter. And, you know, eventually that's going to stop.
Right.
And what's going to happen to the regime at that point? Because I think a lot of their stability is from the fact that, hey, the party's on.
The
boom is going. Eventually, after a boom, there's a bust.
Yeah, that's right. China's not immune to the law of economic physics. And they are experiencing a downturn right now, actually, and stagnation over the last year or two. And most economists think that's going to continue, that 7%, if in fact 7% is a real figure, there's a lot of debate about statistical manipulation. Most economists think it's closer to 5 at the moment. But the prognostications for China's growth over the next decade or two are pretty unanimous. It's all going to come down to 4 or 5%. And that's normal. I mean, it's very abnormal that a country should have the kind of growth rates that they've had for the last three decades. All very positive in many ways, and you're quite right. It's raised the per capita income and literally built the country. The infrastructure is extraordinary. But so is the inequality, and many, many domestic problems, beginning with the environment, which is catastrophic. The corruption, which is catastrophic.
Human rights abuse.
Human rights is, China's not as bad as North Korea or Syria or other abusers, but China's certainly not exemplary either in this regard. So China's got a lot of domestic problems. And you're quite right, Rich, to ask what happens when the economy does take a real downturn. What's that going to mean for the regime and the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party? Because they have literally banked a lot of their legitimacy on continued growth and improving the standard of living of 1.4 billion people. And in addition to nationalism, the kind of two major sources, economic growth and welfare and nationalism. So there's a connection between the deterioration, perhaps, of the economy and what we're seeing with Japan and China's assertiveness in its own neighborhood and the difficulties China's having with other countries. That China's not the first country, you know, that may pick fights and try and deflect attention from domestic problems. But the economy is a difficulty. For the Chinese, the issue is really not growth rates and numbers. It's a qualitative issue and how China moves up the value chain of production and stops simply being the factory of the world, and exporting low-end manufactured goods to our shelves. They've done that for three decades. But the question is really is how do they escape what's known as the middle income trap and begin to be creators and innovators and set standards for technologies and product lines, which is a situation that Japan faced, South Korea faced, Taiwan faced, other newly industrialized countries have all faced and have managed more or less to innovate their way out of that. China, it's an open question whether China can innovate their way out of the middle income trap. That's kind of the big issue to look at over the next decade or two. I have my doubts because it's tied directly to the nature of the Chinese educational system And that is tied directly to the nature of the Chinese political system. So as long as you have an authoritarian political system that leads to an educational system that does not reward risk and is rote, it's all about rote memorization of, for examinations and conformist. It's basically a very conformist intellectual environment. You're not going to become innovative. So until you have a political change, you're not going to change, in my view, you're not going to change the educational system. And if you don't change the educational system, you're not going to become an innovative economy. So these are big underlying issues facing China.
And I think skeptics would also look to the big business issues between the United States, and they say it's hacking and cyber hacking,
right,
and the theft of intellectual property, or the laws that encourage the theft of intellectual property in China.
It's a huge problem, has been for a long time, not getting any better. It's getting worse, in fact.
Is there anything the United States can do to get China to clamp down on that somewhat, or to stop it?
Well, they have the leverage of the World Trade Organization and the Berne Convention for intellectual property. You know, there are international bodies that the United States or any other country can go to and file cases against China or any other country that violates the regulations of intellectual property. And we do that. We file cases, the U.S. government, that is, file cases. The European Union does frequently. But it doesn't seem to have much effect domestically.
There's only one punitive action, which is, you know, suspending or adding tariffs or something like that to that. And I don't think most economies are going to want to take that step.
It would immediately trigger counteractions by the Chinese, and we would be in a trade war very quickly because we're in an interdependent economic relationship with the Chinese, and they hold leverage over us, including all the treasury bonds that they own in the United States, and we have leverage over them. So we don't want to go down that path. We want the Chinese to respect intellectual property according to their own laws and international standards. So as long as there's no domestic incentive for that, they're going to continue to violate intellectual property. So it's really a question of – it's linked to this innovation question, actually. So if China wants to move up the value chain, escape the middle-income trap, become an innovative country, they've got to protect their own intellectual property, okay?
Right.
So there's an incentive. So it's not what the outside world can do on this issue. It's China's own government to enforce its own laws.
Well, in fact, if you look at our history, we did the same thing in the 19th century, and then once our innovation came in, we said, hey, we need protection.
Right.
And we did the same thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, it's really interesting. The new book is titled China Goes Global, The Partial Power. David Shambaugh, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, great to be back in Tulsa. Thank you, Rich.
David Shambaugh is the director of the China Policy Program and a professor of political science at George Washington University. His most recent book is titled China Goes Global, The Partial Power. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations this past Thursday evening. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.